From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd in for Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. There's more uncertainty today inside the White House as the Trump administration searches for a new national security advisor. Retired General Michael Flynn resigned late last night as pressure mounted over his potentially illegal conversations with the Russian ambassador before the inauguration and over concerns that the two men discussed U.S. sanctions on Russia. This morning on NBC's Today Show, Matt Lauer asked the president's counselor, Kellyanne Conway, to explain her statements yesterday that Flynn had the president's full confidence, even though the Justice Department officials reportedly told the White House several weeks ago that Flynn had misled the administration.
They even went further to say that as a result of that dishonesty, he was at risk for blackmailing by the Russians.
Well, that's one characterization. But the fact is that General Flynn continued in that position and was in the presidential daily briefings, was part of the leader calls as recently as yesterday, was there for the prime minister's visit from Canada yesterday. And as time wore on, obviously the situation had become unsustainable.
Kellyanne,
General Flynn.
That makes no sense.
Joining us now, Ron Elving, NPR's senior Washington editor and correspondent. And Ron, a lot of questions being asked today, including did President Trump direct Flynn to talk about sanctions with the Russian ambassador? What other questions do you have?
There are so many questions, Peter, but let's start with this. How many calls did go back and forth between General Flynn and the Russian ambassador, and what other Russians might he have been in contact and correspondence with for how long? Was this just in the period of time after he had been named the National Security Advisor for the new administration, in other words, November and December? Or were there also calls during the campaign, as has been alleged? And why, and this is perhaps the most bedeviling of all these questions, why did Michael Flynn believed that he could characterize what went on in these telephone calls with the Russian ambassador to Vice President Pence and to others on his own terms? Did he not realize these calls were being monitored and that other ears were hearing them and that other minds were going to interpret them and that this might not come to light, which indeed it did in the Washington Post last week?
So people want answers to these questions. Do you think we will be hearing more from Michael Flynn? Will he be subpoenaed?
It's difficult to imagine that the House Intelligence Committee, which is chaired by Devin Nunes and where the ranking Democrat is Adam Schiff, who has been very, very out front on this and doing a lot of media about it, are not going to want to ask him of these some of these questions. Now, the Senate Intelligence Committee under Richard Burr may want to ask them too, but we've heard much more from the folks on the House side. And one of the questions that they have is the question of encryption. Did he have these communications with the Russian ambassador in some kind of encrypted form? And is that why he thought that he could characterize them any way he wanted? Because he thought he had frustrated our own intelligence community and their efforts to monitor the Russian ambassador.
Well, speaking of Congress, here's House Speaker Paul Ryan this morning when asked if there should be a congressional investigation.
I'm not going to prejudge circumstances surrounding this. I think the administration will explain the circumstances that led to this. The Intelligence Committee has been looking into this thing all along, by the way, just involvement with respect to Russia. I think it's really important that as soon as they realize that they were being misled by their National Security Advisor, they asked for his resignation. I can't speak to the rest of the circumstances. I think we need to get all of that information before we prejudge anything.
Look, Ron, for Republicans, this has to be a huge distraction to any policy work that they were hoping to do. Democrats, meanwhile, probably looking for a way to leverage this. What else are you hearing in Washington?
Well, what the speaker just said is a little troubling because he said that the White House asked for the resignation just as soon as they knew something about Flynn and what he'd been up to with respect to the Russian ambassador. That does not seem to square with the facts. First off, it doesn't even seem clear that they asked for his resignation. We were told last night in the 10 o'clock hour that he had resigned. We did not hear that the president had asked for it or that the vice president had asked for it or that anyone else had asked for it, although that does seem likely. We also have seen in the Washington Post this morning, and they actually had reported this shortly before the resignation last night, that the Department of Justice had notified the White House some weeks ago, that is to say the Trump White House that there had been these phone calls and that the existence of these phone calls might compromise Michael Flynn as national security advisor because at some point the Russians might use them as leverage on him. They were notified of that several weeks ago by the Justice Department, and they did not at that time ask for his resignation.
Quickly, Ron, because the president seems to be trying to push this aside, saying this morning that the real story is why are there so many illegal leaks coming out of Washington. Just quickly, your thoughts on what kind of insight we're getting about the inner workings of the White House now in the fourth week.
There do seem to be an unusual number of leaks. They seem to be coming from many of the people who are the principal players inside the White House. But if you want to talk about security, you might want to also look at what happened at Mar-a-Lago on Saturday night when secure communications were shared by the president around the dinner table with a number of his guests.
NPR's Ron Elving, thanks very much.
Thank you, Peter.
Well, the recent arrests by immigration officials of hundreds of immigrants who have no documentation are, of course, causing concern in immigrant communities, and that anxiety is making its way into schools. In Austin, Texas, teachers and local education groups are trying to ease fears through education. Kate McGee from Here Now contributor KUT has more.
If an immigration officer goes to your door, what you have to remember is you don't open that door.
About 20 men and women sit in the cafeteria with their children at Rodriguez Elementary in South Austin after school. They listen to Yunwin Alvarado with the local teachers' union, Education Austin.
So ICE can only enter your home if they have a warrant that is signed by a judge from a criminal court.
All of the people here are immigrants. They're attending one of Education Austin's Know Your Rights seminar. The union has a $30,000 grant from the National Education Association for this kind of work. It reviews what a person's rights are if ICE agents come to their home, stop them on the street, at a checkpoint, or at work.
So if you encounter an immigration officer on the street, the first thing that you have to remember there is that you don't run, because the moment that you run, that can be used against you. It makes you look guilty.
Some parents expressed concern about what would happen to their children if they were arrested while their children were at school.
If families are living in an apartment and they see the ICE band taking someone, then they take pictures and then people get worried.
That's Montserrat Garibay, vice president of Education Austin and a pre-K teacher.
It might not be a raid per se, but for people not knowing that these ICE agents have warrants, it's going to seem like a raid.
Garibay says it's difficult for immigrant families to get accurate information about what's happening and what their rights are.
One of the things that we really want to say to people, to communities, come down, have a safe plan, and then plan what are your next actions if that happens. That's our role, really, to tell people that they can get resources and know what to do.
At the seminar, parents got packets to fill out a plan for their family in case of an immigration emergency. Late last week, dozens of people were arrested by immigration officers in the Austin area and in at least six other states. In a statement, ICE says it regularly conducts targeted enforcement operations to apprehend, quote, deportable foreign nationals. The agency denies that it was doing sweeps or checkpoints in the area. A lack of communication about the arrests caused confusion and panic in local immigrant communities. That anxiety has bled into schools and classrooms.
Overall, I've been more quiet than usual, so I don't talk to friends as much about anything. So same goes for my parents.
That's Lisandro, a 14-year-old freshman at Austin Achieve Charter School in East Austin. He immigrated from Mexico. None of the students I spoke with wanted to give their last names because they are undocumented.
I feel useless when it comes to talking about these type of things that scare my parents. And I don't want to give in to the fear and just give up. But it's kind of hard to keep going when all of this is happening and you're just worried about what's going to happen to your family.
The lack of information about these arrests made students at Austin Achieve realize the need for more accurate information. So 9th and 10th grade students have been spending time with worried middle school students. 16-year-old Katya was one of the students leading these conversations.
We got to talk in a circle, and then we find out that, yes, some people are just feeling really stressed and they don't know what's going on. So we have come to a conclusion that we need to put more information out there for like parents and scholars to know more about what's going on instead of just randomly saying little pieces of things that they heard.
Austin Achieve students say teachers have been providing information about what to do if students encounter ICE agents, and they feel like school is a safe place. Montserrat Garibay with Education Austin says Austin's public schools need to keep telling their families that schools are safe, too. Superintendent Paul Cruz sent a memo to the school community that included general information about resources for refugee and immigrant students. But Garibay says the district and the Austin School Board need to go farther than that.
Dr. Cruz and the school board members need to come out and say, this is a safe place. ICE is not going to come to our schools. I think that's very important for the families to hear.
The Austin School Board has been drafting a resolution in support of its immigrant and undocumented families for at least 6 months, but the resolution was stalled because of board politics and the current political climate. For Here and Now, I'm Kate McGee in Austin.
Thank you for joining us on this unusually warm January.
Recently, we sat down at the Massachusetts Historical Society with author and longtime foreign correspondent Stephen Kinzer.
It is my pleasure to welcome Stephen and Robin.
Thank you.
The topic? Only the biggest debate in American history about what kind of country America was going to be. Very simply put, in 1898, interventionists led by President McKinley, Teddy Roosevelt, the man who would succeed him, Senator Henry Cabot Lodge, newspaper giant William Randolph Hearst, and poet Rudyard Kipling were whipping up support for Americans to join rebel forces in colonial Cuba and the Philippines in overthrowing Spanish rule. Remember the Maine, they said, pointing to the sinking of an American ship in Havana Harbor. Never mind, it was probably an accident, not an attack. On the anti-expansionist side, humorist Mark Twain, steel magnate Andrew Carnegie, orator Booker T. Washington. The debate in Congress over ratifying a war resolution against Spain was pandemonium. Congressmen lunged at each other. Women screamed. A page was knocked out cold. Then, despite promises to rebels that America would leave after victory over the Spanish, the U.S. government decided, actually, we're seizing you. The Supreme Court agreed, and seemingly overnight, the U.S. became an imperialist power.
All of the arguments that we made about whether or not to get into Vietnam or Central America or the Middle East all originally were made at this time. The battle over that ratification, it riveted the entire nation. But we've more or less forgotten this debate. And then the Supreme Court had to rule on whether it was constitutional for Americans to rule other countries and not give them any rights. And they ruled that it was okay by a 5-4 vote. This, in the history of American foreign policy, is truly the mother of all debates. The only difference between that one and this one is not the themes, it's how articulate they were. Talking about the Cataline conspiracy of Pliny the Elder in ways that you'd never expect to hear a senator speak today.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about that. When the anti-imperialists, when they argued, what are you talking about? We have a government of the people, by the people. People like Roosevelt and Lodge said, oh no, that's white people.
Exactly. White people are capable of governing themselves. Dark-skinned people are not, and therefore we have to go in, even though they're not asking us. So Booker T. Washington actually stood up at a speech when McKinley was giving a big address in Chicago and pointed out, as long as we were oppressing people in other countries, we would then view with apathy the idea of doing that here at home. The argument the anti-imperialists made was essentially, as you point out, our country was founded as a rebellion against foreign domination. How can we now go and impose our will on others? Suddenly, we found ourselves in possession of the Philippines, didn't know what to do with it. But President McKinley, after getting down on his knees and having a religious vision in the White House at night, said that he had been told by God that it was his duty to go to the Philippines, take them over, and Christianize the people there. Apparently, he wasn't clear that most of them were Catholic already after several centuries of Spanish rule. That became then the crux of our debate. So we signed a treaty with Spain, and we paid $20 million for the Philippines. Andrew Carnegie immediately announced he wants to pay the U.S. Treasury $20 million to buy the Philippines so he can set them free. Carnegie wrote this fierce essay saying, how can we hang the Declaration of Independence on the wall in schoolhouses in the Philippines when we have made it illegal in the Philippines to advocate Filipino independence. So a huge war broke out in the Philippines. For the first time in our history, the United States wound up in a war in which we had to shoot down people who legitimately felt that they were fighting for their own independence. Hundreds of thousands of people were killed in that war. We've largely forgotten it. In fact, I think we've entirely forgotten it. But it was a huge moment in U.S.-Asia relations. And some of you may have noticed just a month or two ago, the president of the Philippines made this startling announcement that he doesn't want to be friends with the United States anymore. But what was hardly reported in the press was that as he made this announcement at a press conference, he was holding up a photograph of U.S. Marines standing over a pit full of dead Filipino civilians more than 100 years ago. While we forget these interventions, they fester and burn in the minds and hearts and souls of people in other countries, and the blowback ultimately reaches us.
When you think of Teddy Roosevelt's incursions in Cuba, I mean, it's almost comical. This idea that he would say, I want to kill someone. He was so excited about killing someone. It'd be jolly. And by the time we get to the end of your telling and what happened in the Philippines, it's heartbreaking. U.S. troops burning villages, murdering civilians, waterboarding. And I love your quote from Mark Twain, water torture to do what? They won't tell you the truth. If somebody is water tortured, they're going to say whatever you want them to say.
Mark Twain, he wasn't just the gentle, wise-cracking grandpa who everybody loved. He was vituperative in his anti-imperialism. He wrote that Theodore Roosevelt was clearly insane and undoubtedly the worst president we have ever had. Roosevelt returned the compliment by saying he would like to skin Mark Twain alive.
I'm at that page right now. And before this, Roosevelt, when he was talking to Kipling about these anti-imperialists like Mark Twain, he said, these jackfools who seriously think that any group of pirates and headhunters needs nothing but independence in order that it be turned forthwith into a dark-hued New England town meeting. But we're missing one piece here of why there was the expansionist movement. American workers were making so many things, they'd run out of Americans to sell them to. And Roosevelt and Lodge in particular were very clear. We need to take other countries so that we can subdue them, civilize them, and then sell them things.
Absolutely. American manufacturers and American farmers had so completely mastered techniques of mass production that they were producing far more than Americans could consume. And this was producing trouble in America. That's when he started having these great labor strikes, and Pinkertons were shooting down strikers in various parts of the country. We felt that there might be serious upheaval coming in the United States. The solution was to take foreign countries. And there's article after article speculating on what it could mean to American workers if the Chinese could be made, for example, to eat beef. What if they started to use metal nails to build their houses? The war in the Philippines did not turn out the way Americans thought it would. We thought, excuse me if you're comparing this to anything else, we thought they would greet us with flowers. We thought it would be over in a few weeks. In fact, the opposite happened. A full-scale rebellion broke out in the Philippines. The Philippines war gripped America because it was something so new for us. We had never fought a foreign guerrilla war, nor had we ever been in the position of having to do terrible things. This was our first torture scandal. The scandal over what was called the water cure, later to be known by another name, at Guantanamo, was really the beginning of a loss of innocence for the United States.
And then after the war, it almost feels as if Roosevelt wants to draw attention away from the failures there by scapegoating the military who carried the war out. There was a Major Anthony Waller who was being questioned during this investigation into what happened here, and of course we know what happened. It was carried out by the expansionists. This major said that General Smith gave him extermination orders. "I want no prisoners," Smith told him. "I wish you to kill and burn. The more you kill and burn, the better you will please me. I want all persons killed who are capable of bearing arms." And so the major asked for an age guideline, and the general said to him, 10 years. Persons 10 years and over, are those designated as being able to bear arms? Yes. And then the major went on to say he was ordered to make it a howling wilderness, and his men complied, razing every village and massacring the civilians. How did that hit at home?
I think it was a loss of innocence for Americans.
Author Stephen Kinzer talking about the aftermath of the Philippine-American and Spanish-American wars at the end of the 1800s. Rudyard Kipling famously wrote, "Take up the white man's burden, your new-caught sullen people, half-devil, half-child." To which someone replied, "We've taken up the white man's burden of ebony and brown. Now will you tell us, Rudyard, how will we put it down?" Stephen's new book is The True Flag. We close his talk at the Massachusetts Historical Society with his quote of German immigrant Carl Schurz, who spoke of the flag Americans should take up.
"The flag of George Washington and Abraham Lincoln, the flag of the government of, for, and by the people, the flag of human rights and of good example to all nations, the flag of true civilization, peace, and goodwill to all men." That's the view that is rarely expressed in the corridors of power in the United States. And part of the purpose of my book is to recover the richness of that dialogue so that we can use it as a basis on which to make our arguments today.
How interesting those words were spoken by an immigrant. Stephen Kinzer.
Thank you.
Hit song from 1900. Again, Stephen Kinzer's book is The True Flag.
This podcast and the following message are made possible by The Economist. From politics to business and finance, from science and technology to the arts, readers are brought clear analysis of the issues that lie behind each week's global news stories. The Economist's content satisfies the globally curious with a distilled view of world affairs that is intelligent, insightful, and thought-provoking. Sign up for an introductory offer at economist.com/now.
There's angry reaction today in Moscow to Michael Flynn's resignation as National Security Advisor. Flynn quit last night, admitting he misled the Trump administration about his conversation with Russia's ambassador to the United States. The BBC's Sarah Rainsford joins us now from Moscow. And Sarah, not much reaction from the Kremlin, but what are others saying?
Well, the Kremlin has reacted in a way in the fact that it said no comment. And in fact, the Kremlin spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, who gives a conference call every morning with journalists, he said three times that he wouldn't comment on this resignation. And that's despite the fact that only yesterday, when he was talking to journalists, he was adamant that sanctions and the lifting of sanctions against Russia was not discussed by Michael Flynn with the Russian ambassador to the United States. So it looked like he'd been caught out. But when he was challenged on that, he refused to comment. So the Kremlin basically sidestepping the whole issue. But there have been a bunch of politicians here, MPs, very senior politicians who have commented, and they're pretty furious at what's happened. And that's interesting in itself, because Russian politicians being furious at domestic policy in the United States in itself is pretty curious.
Why is that? Are they furious because there were some Russians who believed that Flynn might actually be able to help lift some of these sanctions?
Yes, I think that's at the heart of it. I do think that he was clearly seen here as an ally, as a friend, as someone who was on Russia's side and who potentially was prepared to help to work to lift those sanctions, which despite Russia's protestations to the contrary, have been pretty damaging for the economy here. And Russia does want to see lifted, although it will never admit to that. So I think he was seen as an important ally, one of several that Russia has hoped to see in President Trump's administration. And so his loss, I think, was felt here. But it was presented as if this was an example of Russophobia in the American administration. These politicians here who've spoken out about it have suggested that this was targeting relations with Russia, that it wasn't about the content of any conversation, but the very fact that there are people within the United States who don't want to see Moscow and Washington becoming friends and allies again.
Well, there has been some reporting here in the United States that the Justice Department told the White House that Flynn's conflict might have exposed himself to Russian blackmail. And from your perspective, there in in Moscow. Does that sound like a reasonable concern to you?
Well, I suppose the suggestion that he might have been offering things that were not his to offer could have been used against him. And that's why all this came about, isn't it? I mean, potentially the Kremlin was recording those conversations too, or the Russian embassy in Washington. So if that's the implication, then I suppose it's possible, although Russia wouldn't have been wanting to compromise anybody who could potentially be helpful to it. And I don't think people like Michael Flynn, who Russia saw as friends, were the ones on its radar.
Well, it looked like there had been a chance, at least under the Trump administration, for warmer ties between the U.S. and Russia. What does this story with Michael Flynn, does that change any of that?
I do think that Russia is still hopeful that on the key issues where it wants to collaborate with Washington, that can still happen. But obviously, it looks like there are limits to the great friendship that Moscow was perhaps hoping for. But I should just add, as far as the Kremlin is concerned, if all of this goes bust, if the relationship can't be restored, then in a sense, Moscow will present that as a win as well. Moscow will present this as its enemies abroad conspiring against it. And that often works in terms of shoring up support for the Kremlin here at home to present these external enemies which really have it in for Russia. Mm.
The BBC's Sarah Rainsford in Moscow. Sarah, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The World War II drama Allied is available today on streaming services. Perfect timing for anyone looking to watch an old-fashioned romance with their Valentine. The film is directed by Robert Zemeckis, who won an Oscar for Forrest Gump. He also directed the classic Back to the Future films. Well, Allied stars Brad Pitt and Marion Cotillard as Max and Marianne. They are spies who meet in wartime Casablanca. Their mission is to pose as husband and wife to assassinate a German ambassador at a party.
The guns will be taped under the champagne table. The ambassador arrives at precisely 8:30.
If he's late.
He's German. He'll be on time.
It gets complicated when Max and Marianne betray the common sense of their industry. They fall in love and get married. And things get really complicated when Marianne is suspected of being a German spy. We spoke with Robert Zemeckis shortly before Allied opened in theaters last November. We'd read that he'd been waiting to direct a World War II film for some time, and I asked him why.
Well, I grew up watching World War II movies, watching World War II television shows. It was something that I became an amateur World War II historian. Something that was a time, a historical time that always appealed to me and I was interested in. So when this project came along, I thought, okay, well, this will be fun.
Did those TV shows and films from your childhood influence this film?
Well, I don't know if they were very different. I mean, because those were mainly films, the ones I was watching as a little kid were – they had a lot of action, a lot of battles and things like that. But this film's mainly – World War II is the backdrop. I mean, this is mainly a romance set in World War II. So I guess it helped me just sort of know what things should look like and, I don't know, certain phraseology, terminology, uniforms, things like that.
Yeah, well, let's play a scene from the movie. Here's Brad Pitt's character, Max, when he's confronted by his boss, played by the great Jared Harris, who right. Some of us might know from Lane Price on Mad Men. Mm-hmm. And Max has just been told that Marianne, his wife, is a German spy.
My wife is not a spy.
If she is, we need to keep her in place for 72 hours so that we can identify her handler and clean out the rest of her circuit. No.
Now, Stephen Knight, who wrote the screenplay, says that this was inspired by a true story and that, in fact, this sort of nightmare scenario actually happened in real life. Is that right?
That's what he told me. I haven't found any actual documentation of it, but that doesn't mean it didn't happen because it all happened in the world of secret agents and things like that.
And the hardest thing about the situation that Max is in is that if, in fact, his wife is a spy, he will have to kill her with his own hands. And I think that gets us to a part of the theme of the film, which is that sometimes anyone who's ever been married might have confronted the fact that we don't really maybe know exactly who it is that we've fallen in love with.
Exactly right. And I think that's the universal idea, the universal theme, if you will, the thing that makes it a story that everyone can identify with. Obviously the World War II setting raises the stakes, but the underlying idea that you may not know exactly who you're married to is a very common idea, universal idea.
And watching the film, I felt this sort of underlying sense of foreboding or doom to come. I mean, I imagine you were playing with our emotions a little bit there.
Yeah, it was done consciously. I mean, I think that you very subtly get a sense that maybe this isn't going to end well. And you get this feeling that, you know, these two people who are obviously very passionately in love, there's something just not quite right.
Well, let's hear a little bit more from the film. Here's a scene at that party where they're supposed to be planning their assassination of the ambassador. Max whispers to Marianne that the ambassador could be late, which could throw off the entire mission. Let's listen to that.
Il est en retard. Qu'est-ce qu'il fait?
Okay, so that was in French.
All now in French.
I played that because here we have Brad Pitt speaking a lot of French. What kind of extra effort did that take?
Well, he worked really hard on that, and it was great because Marianne helped him the whole time, and you know, and she
native French speaker.
Yeah, and she, you know, and she wanted him to speak, you know, perfect Parisian French, which his character is supposed to do. So she was pretty hard on him, but I can't speak French, so I had to rely on all of our technical advisors and, of course, Marianne and Brad, but he did a really good job.
When you're shooting a scene with actors who don't speak the language they're trying to speak, how many takes do you have to do?
You do the same amount as if they're speaking English. I mean, you have one more person who has to weigh in, which is the – like I said, whoever the language dialogue coach is, the French-speaking dialogue coach. I'll do a take and it feels good performance-wise, and then I'll look back at the dialogue coach and he'll say, well, you know, he kind of missed this little word and this little thing and this thing here, and so we have to do another one and we'll do it again. And it's just like doing a take in your native language. You just have one more thing that you have to do.
Yeah, sure. Well, look, this film has a really old Hollywood feel to it, the way it looks. In fact, the first quarter of it takes place in Casablanca, which – I don't know. It feels like it could be an homage to the classic film. Was that deliberate?
Well, you know, the script was set in Casablanca, and it's important to the story. And, I mean, obviously the film Casablanca is such an iconic film that any time another movie set in that era, which is the 1940s, is in Casablanca, it's going to feel like a homage. But it was important to the story because, you know, when we did the research and I read the screenplay, you know, Casablanca in the early 40s was really exactly like the movie Casablanca. It was full of spies and shady characters, and there was a lot going on there. Hmm. And it was also a very glamorous place because it was considered to be the Riviera of North Africa, and it had a very sophisticated, you know, French influence. And so it was very much like the actual movie. So it feels like a homage, but we were presenting it very accurately.
Your resume is filled with films that have become classics. Let's listen to this.
My mom always said life was like a box of chocolates. You never know what you're going to get.
I'm not bad. I'm just drawn that way.
Roads, where we're going, we don't need roads.
Okay, you know this very well, but for those who don't, that was Back to the Future that we just heard. Who Framed Roger Rabbit? And of course, Forrest Gump. Robert Zemeckis, what is it about those movies that you made that made them so great?
well, that's – I'm probably the last person who can answer that question. You know, I was just doing the best I could to make the movie, you know, work and enjoyable and entertaining. You know, I guess if I were to really, you know, be honest about it and break it down, I think it's because they're, you know, they're characters that are endearing and timeless. I really believe that that's the thing that, you know, would make a film sort of last for decades and stay in the pop culture mentality of the
– Marty McFly and people like Forrest Gump.
And people like Forrest Gump. But, you know, I mean, sort of the innocence of Forrest is something that's very charming and very like lovable and people identify with. Plus, there's also, you know, Forrest Gump has a lot of – you know, the theme, you know, in Forrest Gump are all different sorts of love. You know, it's love of a mother for a child, the love of – two deep friends with, you know, Forrest and Lieutenant Dan's, you know, relationship and, you know, obviously the romantic story between Forrest and Jenny. And, you know, so there's a lot of universal themes in that movie, of course.
Yeah, and when you're making a film, do you have a sense that this one will become a classic, or does it sometimes surprise you after
I think you can never know that. All you ever hope for is that, you know, people, you know, will go to the movie, and no one can ever know that or feel that in the process as something that happens after the fact. And that's why I said I'm probably the last person who could ever actually explain why these films have lasted as long as they have. That's something I think that film scholars will have to do.
Among your long list of films, where do you think Allied will end up?
I have no idea. I think that people who go see the movie are going to really have a really entertaining time. And it's a story about an incredibly passionate love story between two people, which is something that is a rarity in the filmscape these days. Now, whether it's going to last after, you know, the opening weekend or not, I have no idea.
Now, that's going to be stressful as a filmmaker.
Well, that's the way, you know, that's the way the movie business has always been. You know, it's a very risky venture. You know, it's what makes it very nerve-wracking and at the same time very exhilarating.
Robert Zemeckis, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Robert Zemeckis speaking with us last November. Allied is available through streaming services today and comes out on DVD later this month.
Yesterday, the prospect of Michael Flynn resigning as National Security Advisor, which he did last night, was a big story. But you wouldn't know it from watching President Donald Trump's press conference with Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. The president called on just two members of the American press. The first was local TV reporter Scott Thuman.
I'm curious, as you move forward on issues from trade to terrorism, how do you see this relationship playing out? And are there any specific areas with which during your conversation?
Well, NPR media correspondent David Fogenflik is here. And David, both Thuman from a TV station owned by Sinclair Broadcasting and a reporter from the Daily Caller, who was the second one asking a question, the conservative-leaning publication founded by Tucker Carlson, both have said they did not share questions with the Trump campaign, but your thoughts about neither asking about the biggest story of the day.
With the Trump White House, yes. Look, I think that Sean Spicer, the press secretary, and the communications folks at the White House don't need to vet the questions ahead of time if they know they're calling on people likely to be sympathetic. Sinclair Broadcasting, I used to cover them years ago when I was a reporter for the Baltimore Sun. They're based outside the city of Baltimore in Baltimore County. They're owned by a family of very conservative brothers, and they have essentially put in place at times the formula on the local news level, very similar to what Fox News has done on the national level. And their story selection and their approach to what is newsworthy, even if they're treating a story fairly, is more in keeping with what you might see on Fox News than what you might see in the pages of the New York Times or on CNN, which is to say they tend to be a little more tempered and protective of the Trump administration and a little bit more focusing on the administration's foes' wrongdoings or missteps. And so what you're seeing now is the White House consciously, while still taking questions from established news outlets, including at times NPR, is packing the newsroom with folks that are likely to ask softer or more sympathetic questions.
Well, last week, during his appearance with Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, Trump called on a reporter from the New York Post, the Rupert Murdoch-owned paper, as well as one from Fox News. Which adds to your thinking.
That's right. I mean, at the moment, Rupert Murdoch is actually leading Fox News quite directly since the resignation of Roger Ailes. It's owned by 21st Century Fox, the corporate sibling of Murdoch's News Corp, which owns the New York Post. You're seeing Fox and its siblings. Fox Business had a reporter recently called on. You're seeing a number of figures. Newsmax, which was a rising and significant conservative news site. Its presence is being greatly elevated by being called on repeatedly by Sean Spicer at these White House press briefings. Breitbart is in the room frequently. Its reporters are called on. And you've seen recently a very conservative website that's championed Trump through the campaign season just receive a White House credential, as they had boasted some weeks ago.
And this was which website? I think I read about that today.
It was Jim Hoft's Gateway Pundit.
Gateway. Yeah.
And he took a picture with his young White House correspondent and, you know, tweeted how excited he was when he heard them talk about immigration restriction policies. It's not exactly what you would hear from a reporter for The Washington Post who had gained entry to the White House press room. Now, let's be clear. There have been point of view publications and outlets that have received passes in the past. The Huffington Post, very much left of center, I believe, was first credentialed under George W. Bush's conservative administration. But you're seeing seeing, to my mind, a kind of packing of the press room at this moment with reporters from outlets known to be already sympathetic to Trump. And I think that what we've seen of the emergence of the calling on local and regional news outlets, instead of giving us a flavor of regionalism, what it's really done is serve to tamp down on that national and major outlets can ask.
Well, David, and by the way, that was not your voice, which we can hear you're struggling with. Then there's the pictures from Mar-a-Lago. A lot of the information that came out about Donald Trump and Shinzo Abe's reaction to the North Korea missile test came out because a member of this exclusive club, Richard Diagazio from Boston, who just joined Mar-a-Lago for $200,000 a few months ago, according to the Boston Globe, was having dinner a couple tables away from the world leaders. And he posted pictures on his Facebook page of aides huddled around the table with cell phone flashlights on secure documents, diners looking on. He also posted a picture of a guy. He said, "This is Rick. Rick is the man. Rick has the nuclear football. He has the suitcase with the nuclear codes, and he's grinning on this diner's Facebook page." You know, people are talking about the security of that moment, but what about the access? Richard Diagazio of Boston had more access to that security dinner than the press did.
You know, I think I saw on Twitter a picture taken by a Univision reporter of Trump sort of sitting at that essentially a banquet table as there was all this tumult, and you could see Steve Bannon and I think Flynn behind him, you know, people rushing to him to get him these documents. It's an astounding moment to be captured. But yes, you know, you have this access by people who've had to pay six figures to be able to be in the club owned by the president, who's in a sense hosting the Japanese prime minister at his private resort, but also in a sense highlighting the importance of his resort in the same moment. It seems like a breach of security. It's an astonishing way to get information. I'm actually thankful for these images to get out because I like to see what our public officials do behind closed doors. But my heavens, that does not seem to me to be a secure way for them to guard national security information. And it's a very weird way for information to bounce through the social media echo chamber to get out through major news organizations.
A sort of a plein air, open air security meeting.
A fresco, I think, is what we're talking about.
NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. Thanks as always, David.
You bet.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.